My name is Dana Boyd, and I'm a PhD student at Berkeley, where I study all sorts of social technologies. And I actually have a funny past, because I used to actually study computer science. And when I was studying computer science, I went to MIT thinking I would build all sorts of visualizations and fun things. And I got there, and I met this character. To my right is Henry Jenkins, and one of the best things about going there and realizing that there were people that actually studied the social practices that came out using all sorts of media, and I was absolutely in love. I was, you know, I got to go to classes where we would study queer theory and watch videos of Buffy, and I was just like, this is just the best. And so I brought him here, you know, in connection with a group of people, including John Lebowski, so that we would actually look at what were going on in the cross-convergence culture that would happen. Because what Henry's been doing for many years has been looking at everything from fan fiction to the World Wrestling Federation and the, you know, performance of gender to what's happening with Remix and all sorts of media production, the collapse of consumption and production. And in the last year, he's actually produced 3 books, which for anybody out there, like, as an academic, I'm just like, you've got to be kidding me. Not only has he produced 3 books, he writes a blog entry, a full blog essay every day of the week, right? And unfortunately, I lost this, but I recommend anybody who's got a laptop out there to go to henryjenkins.org, which is where he blogs about all sorts of things that are of relevance to you. And I guess my goal here is to, you know, interview him and, you know, provide some sort of insight into what he's doing and how it relates to this audience. I'm going to do some questions, and then I'm going to open up for you for questions. And I should note that we're going to have to use the mic in the center. So be prepared for that when we open to it. So I guess where to begin, Henry, is that your early work about fandom, you approached it from the point of view of a fan. How did you first become a fan, and what does fandom mean to you?
Well, I'm not sure I can remember a moment in my life when I wasn't a fan. I grew up with an older cousin who kept Famous Monsters of Filmland magazines and Mad magazines and had comic books all over his apartment. And that was the cool cousin that I identified with, and it really shaped my relationship. By the time I got to college, I was totally into geek fan cultures and was active as a fanboy, and met a wonderful fangirl, a woman named Cynthia, who's now my wife, and discovered that while we were both fans, we read in fundamentally different ways. That part of falling in love, I think, was discovering how to read as a female fan and understanding the very different ways we approached the same text. We were both Star Trek fans. I remember there's the episode, The Menagerie, which may be known to many of you here. And Spock in that episode suddenly gets very emotional. Now, as a male fan, I would go behind the scenes and I'd try to figure out what's the backstory. This was actually the pilot. They recast many of the parts. Spock was reconceptualized between the pilot and when he reached the ear. Blah, 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 blah. All, you go meta. For Cynthia, the question was, how do we explain this within the psychology of the character? That Spock is half human, half Vulcan. He obviously had gone through a period of time of exploring his Vulcan side, so surely he would be understanding his human side as well, and converts act more passionately than people who grew up in that culture. So he's acting out being human at that moment in his life. And so it was working within the text, understanding it, and that's exactly what leads to things like fan fiction. So when I got to grad school, I was actively a fan. That's what drew me to graduate school in media studies to begin with. And I discovered that fans were not held in very high esteem by academics. Indeed, most of what was written about fans treated us as sort of dupes of the culture industry, as emotionally immature, one step above William Shatner telling us to get a life. And at some morning, I woke up and said, I'm tired of being told I get a life. I want to write a book instead and try to set the record straight about the passion that drives fan culture and the creative appropriation and remixing of content that's fundamental to the ways fans think about the world. This was 20 years ago, mind you. Textual Poetry is the book that I wrote, came out 16 years ago. And it was written at a time that fans were totally marginal to the ways in which the culture industries operated. They were hidden from view. You know, they lived in their parents' basement as far as the public was concerned. And I myself called them rogue readers in that book, describing the ways they read differently than producers expected. Well, flash forward to the present, Convergence Culture, my new book, has come out at a time that fans are absolutely central to the ways that the culture industries operate. What everyone else is calling Web 2.0 is fandom without the stigma. It's people who, you know, it's what we've been doing for 20 years. right? It's a social community that shares knowledge, that works together to solve conceptual problems, that pools resources to create a common culture, that appropriates and remixes content. That's what fans were doing in their parents' basements 20 years ago. And now major industries are making money out of this. And so convergence culture is trying to describe what fan culture at a moment in which it's absolutely central to the way our culture operates. And that's leading to the other sort of things that are going on, that major industries are learning from fan culture, that political activists are modeling themselves after fan cultures, that church activities are modeled after fan culture, that the participatory culture that seemed so exotic when I first entered grad school is absolutely central to the world we live in today. And that's why you suddenly have some fanboy like me sitting in front of a packed auditorium at South by Southwest.
So what role has the internet played in sort of the rise of fandom, and how has it shaped it and shifted it?
Well, in a half a dozen ways. I mean, the simple one is that more people find their way into fandom. When it was people's basements, when it was, you know, people gathering in hotel lobbies and passing mimeographs back and forth, it was not going to be highly visible. Now more people are finding fandom than ever before. In any given fandom, take Harry Potter, there may be 500,000 fan stories in circulation on the web written by amateurs, many of them as sophisticated or more sophisticated than anything J.K. Rowling is going to ever produce. Many of those fans found their way in because they found it on the web, not because they were part of the social community there. So that's step one, is the expansion of it. Second is the speed of it, the degree to which you can be watching a TV show now, and within 5 minutes of the episode starting, you're already getting the discussions going on online. We're now talking and watching in real time, and that's changing the way we watch. It leads to this world of collective intelligence that convergence culture talked about. So that, 15 years ago, more or less, I did a study of Twin Peaks online. And it was one of the first shows to really develop an intense fan following online. And what was interesting was that we were seeing people, the newspaper critics were complaining that the show had become so complicated no one could follow it. And if you went online, the fans were complaining the show had been dumbed down so much it was no longer interesting. Now, what was going on there was not that the fans online were so much smarter than the newspaper critics, although I'm willing to entertain that hypothesis. But it's that people watching together in a collective community, sharing knowledge, processing it week by week, demanded more complexity, wanted more from the television they were watching than those people who watched as isolated individuals sitting in their living room and maybe talking to the person on the couch across from them. So that change in the way we watch television, the movement to online communities around television, has led to greater and greater demands for complexity. And the result is what Stephen Johnson talks about in Everything Bad is Good for You, a world where television is getting more complex, where schools are dumbing down and television is demanding more of its viewers than ever before. Right? And this paradox, you know, that Pokemon expects our kids to remember 250 characters, and that the schools are not certain if they should learn a pantheon of Greek gods. You know, and I think that's the gap we're in. So the biggest change has been this collective viewing pattern results in greater demands for complexity and greater insistence that the audience have space to participate. And what we're seeing is that the audience's activities are now as visible in some cases as the activities of the media producers, and that tension is playing itself out is in defining what we're calling participatory culture. And that's the heart of what convergence culture is trying to describe, is this moment of time in which the audience becomes more central to the way culture operates, and their power comes not from individual fans, but from the collective energies of large-scale communities processing complex media content together, and therefore demanding more from the media that they're consuming and producing, demanding more opportunities participate, demanding more backstory, demanding a richer and more a world that extends across multiple media platforms.
So one of the places that you're seeing is as this rise, as you know, Remix and all sorts of fandom comes into fruition, it becomes also available to the creators themselves. And unfortunately, many of them have not been so thrilled to see this fandom rise and to see their materials being used. And one of the places I'm seeing this is that fans are now getting sued for their uses of copyright. What do you think about this, and where is this going?
Well, I mean, we need to start with a basic premise that the media producers have already lost control, that most of the people in the entertainment industry are worried about losing control. The reality is I and my friends can take your media content and do with it whatever we want in whatever format we want in whatever context we want, and the likelihood of you stopping us is almost zero. So you have to get over the moment where producers are worried about losing control and instead recognize the opportunities created for collaboration, for new insights, for expanding the impact of the culture, of the content on society. It's about moving from a world where fans are assumed to depreciate the value of intellectual properties to a world where they actually appreciate them. And appreciate them in the double sense that they emotionally are invested in them, they like them, they appreciate them, and in the economic sense, they increase their value. That's the world we live in right now. One of the stories, many of you follow the stories of the Browncoats, the group around Serenity and Firefly, that were so central to the media coverage of that phenomenon. They printed, made t-shirts, they did publicity, they sat outside theater, did all kinds of amazing things. When the film left the theaters, the studio sent them not only a cease and desist letter, but a bill for their unauthorized use of those images on their t-shirts. This community organized online, collected and counted up all the hours they contributed to the project and sent the studio a bill for billable hours. Right? As the invoices crossed in the mail, I think the studio executives figured out that the fans had generated much more value than they cost, and it made a lot more sense to enfranchise fans, to empower them, than to try to shut them down. And that's the, well, right now what we're seeing is a whole spectrum of attitudes that companies have toward their fans that go from prohibitionist attitudes, let's just shut them down, ask questions later, send cease and desist letters to 14-year-old girls who write Harry Potter stories, to, on the other hand, let's enfranchise the fans, let's talk about user-generated content, let's collaborate with this audience, and let's use them as our vanguard of marketing, publicity, and so forth. That let's recognize the unpaid and invisible labor of fans as increasing the value of our properties in really rich and exciting ways. So we could tell the story of Four-Eyed Monsters, that is the independent film that is now having people identify people that they'd like to see the film in their area, coming together on the web, and then take that list of potential customers to local theaters and saying, why don't you show this movie? We can sell you out. You know, we can sell out your house. That's a very different relation to fans than sending cease and desist letters. So yeah, I'm very concerned that the control over intellectual property is one of those battlegrounds that we're in right now, which will determine whether our culture becomes more participatory or not and what those terms of participation are. It is the participatory culture I care about is being threatened on one hand by Hollywood and on the other hand by Hollywood's enemies. You know, it's being threatened by corporate control of copyright and government attempts to censor popular culture. And it's caught in the vices of those two pressures. And I think until we can find out a rationale for it. Part of the problem, though, is that many of the free speech groups, many of the groups that have been advocating for electronic freedom have not embraced fan culture because it's not technological, it's social and cultural. They're, you know, the amount of energy that's been put in battling for Napster, say, or BitTorrent versus the amount of money that's been put in defending these fan fiction writers who are creating rich and original culture and simply distributing it via the web is radically different. And I think, in fact, the struggle over intellectual property should be fought through fans who create derivative products through remixing and appropriation and transformation rather than technology platforms, which, in fact, arguably are often used in direct piracy and are really hard to defend against the charge that they're piracy tools. That if we really want to gain ground on this, we should be going after those people who transform culture. But that's not what goes on. So like Christmas last year, I got a phone call from a woman who'd written the Brokeback Mountain fan fiction story in which she dealt with the ways that those two men could come together, have an emotionally fulfilling relationship. She was frustrated. She loved the character. She was frustrated by the resolution of the film. So she wrote a novel, which meant a great deal to a large number of people. She put it on the web and she got a cease and desist letter, not from the film producers, but from the writer of the original short story. And she was struggling to try to figure out what to do. And I tried to connect her with half a dozen leading intellectual property attorneys out there who write about free culture. And almost none of them were willing to talk to her and really give her any practical advice about how to deal with a world where a studio's coming at you and it's got a whole team of lawyers. And no matter what your rights are, you're sitting there as someone whose house may be, you know, you're going to give up your house. You're going to give up your kids' college funds. Or you're going to take your story offline. You're going to take your story down, no matter how much it means to people. But that's a bullying. That's a bullying overassertion of intellectual property authority that goes so far beyond what I think the courts would recognize at this point. Yet no one is standing up for these people, and no one's protecting their rights to participate in our culture. It's a fundamental struggle we're involved in. If we're going to see a more fertile, generative culture, we're going to see a participatory culture. We've got to get behind those people.
So I see this bullying as part of a larger issue, which is about how government and, you know, in many ways, those who have power are trying to assert it over those who don't, particularly cultural producers, many of which are young people. And I know that you've written extensively about what young people are doing and how they're participating and are looking in many ways at the new legislation that is coming down, everything from DOPA to its, you know, children. Can you tell the audience more about what's going on and what that whole environment looks like and what should be done?
Yeah, what I've described so far in terms of fan culture is part of this larger texture of participatory culture. So the Pew Center for Internet and American Life showed us a little while ago that 57% of American teenagers online have become media producers. About 33% of teenagers online share media they produce with people beyond their immediate friends and families. That's a fundamental shift from a culture of spectators to a culture of participants. And it's very important. Through the work we're doing with the MacArthur Foundation on New Media Literacies, we're interested in both that 57%, those kids who are producing media, and what it means to turn loose these kids in a world where they get with enormous power and reach, but very little knowledge and very little adult supervision, advice, and so forth. And the 43% who are being locked out, who are not able to participate, what we're calling the participation gap, is a fundamental part of that. Now, the bill DOPA, which the Deleting Online Predators Act, which you and I both wrote about last year as it was working its way through Congress, would essentially strip schools and public libraries from providing access to social networking and blogging technologies for students. So put this in the context. We fought for almost more than a decade to close the digital divide, which was understood in technical terms as ensuring that every kid in America had access to network computing through the schools and public libraries of no place else. Now that we've got there, you know, there's some resistant pockets, Native American reservations, some rural areas, but by and large, we're there where kids have access. But those kids have such grossly unequal access in a world where some people have mobile technologies, broad bandwidth, 24/7 access, and someone else is at a school library that gets 10 minutes of access a day, can't store anything long term, can't really upload anything from where they're based at, low bandwidth, mandatory federal filtering on the web itself. Now we're talking about adding to it restrictions on social networks and blogging technology. That's what I mean, the participation gap, the gap in the ability to use this stuff and the ability to acquire knowledge, to develop the cultural skills that will allow you to be successful in a network society and a participatory culture. So what DOPA is, this legislation, is it was passed by the House by overwhelming majorities. So don't let anyone tell you it's a right-wing cultural conservatives. The liberal Democrats are as much behind this as cultural conservatives. The way that Hillary and Lieberman and those guys can appeal to security moms and sell out a core without having to sell out a core constituency, right? It's about appealing moderate by sort of betraying American young people on this legislation. And if it was not for the support of liberal Democrats, this legislation would be going nowhere. It bogged down in the Senate last fall, in part because Mark Foley was one of the major authors of it. Interesting, he wanted to go after child predators. And then this year it's been reintroduced as Protecting Children in the 21st Century Act and by Ted Stevens, he of the Pipes. So Stevens is back with this piece of legislation, which will have an enormous impact on young people's access to technology. And all signs are it will pass unless the community gets behind it and really tries to call attention to what's going on. The point I make is that even if you believe the most cultural conservative nightmare that MySpace is a crawl with social predators, and you and I know that it's not, but even if we bought that scenario, you need to ask your conservative friends whether those kids are more safe if we train teachers and librarians to give them some skills and guidance as they use this technology, or whether we lock the schoolhouse and library and say, deal with it on your own, kids. Because that's what that legislation does, is essentially turns kids loose outside of any adult supervision to deal with it on their own, while locking out the 43% of American teens who are not part of an online participatory culture yet, but who would like to get into that space. So it both exaggerates the inequality of digital media and leaves kids who you might claim to be going to protect more at risk than ever before. It's just fundamentally a bad piece of legislation. But when I said before that it's the war, that our participatory culture is shaped by Hollywood and its enemies, That's the enemy's part. This is the example of government in Washington adopting a culture war attitude and going after youth participatory and youth and participatory culture online in a fundamental way that's going to create further inequalities. And so these teenagers are being hit with cease and desist letters from studios and having their access ripped out from the schools and public libraries all at the same time. And that's what we need to think about. So while we may think of social networking as the engine that's driving wealth production in Web 2.0, it is also that space under fire in educational institutions, the lives of American young people, and the lives of American fans at the same moment. And we really need to put all those pieces together and think about them systematically if we're going to understand this rhetoric about Time Magazine naming us or you the person of the year. You is under fire right now. Your right to participate is under siege. And we need to think about what's the right way to deal with those issues.
I guess one of the heartbreaking things for me is that DOPA is not the only piece of legislation and it's children that are coming down. I got a phone call last week from ABC because the Attorney General of Connecticut has decided that all social technologies are now going to be required to implement age verification technology if their piece of legislation goes through. That's not just a matter of like saying you're 16, but somehow proving it, which is uncertain how that will happen. And that anybody under 18 would be required to get formalized parental permission for use of any technology that would let them communicate with anyone else. And you sit there going, okay, which is, I guess, for me, another thing, one, to the, you know, site's creators out there, this is terrifying because I think it would be devastating to the entire industry. But for me, it's also frustrating because it comes back to this question of, you know, what role do parents have in this conversation and, you know, for me, the idea of queer kids not being able to, or having to get parental permission to go to queer, you know, teen groups is pretty horrifying. And I'm wondering if you see a scenario that, you know, would allow for protection that would not be so devastatingly frustrating.
I don't know. Fear sells. I mean, this is something I wrote about recently in the blog, was there's a politics of fear out here. And it's very effective. And it's tied to the politics of terror, as we found out in Boston. You know, where we have a mayor who can't tell the difference between a cartoon character and a bomb, and who now wants to advise the government on violent video games and MySpace and a variety of other issues, which he's equally ill-informed about, right? But that doesn't slow down governments very much right now. So, but the politics of fear, as I said, is the one issue that in a highly partisan society, the one issue the Democrats and Republicans agree on is that our kids should be muzzled. You know, I find that a really disturbing proposition, that there's no partisanship on these issues at all. They're going to be passed by overwhelming majorities, and it's going to be very hard to slow this sort of mounting. And the politics of fear has a gender dimension that is, I think, worth noting, that we're afraid of our sons and we're afraid for our daughters. And that's the way to think about it. If we read Columbine and video games as the archetypically male anxiety, it's about adolescent men being so preoccupied with popular culture that they're out of control. It's about young, and MySpace is the archetypical female anxiety, which is young women are going to be seduced by the technology, that they're vulnerable, their innocence needs to be protected. We can start to see the mechanisms by which this operates. But until we as a society say, I'm tired of being led by fear, and that I want to be led by knowledge, it's going to be very hard to slow that down. Now, you and I are both involved in one way or another with the MacArthur Initiative. MacArthur announced a $50 million commitment over the next 5 years to really look systematically at how young people are learning through their relations to digital media inside and outside of school. This is the most systemic effort to really understand the kinds of informal learning and cultural participation, civic engagement that's emerging in digital space for young people. And it's bringing together literally hundreds of scholars around the country working to get information. What we need to do is that information comes out, and MacArthur is doing a good job of publicizing it through its blog, and I write about it in my blog, is to use that information to challenge the fear-mongering that's going on in Washington and to call attention to the mechanisms by which this fear is being manipulated. And it requires us joining forces across partisan divides. That if we're battling a bipartisan force in Washington, we actually have to pull together across the bickering that takes place between partisan blogs and really find ways that we can protect the infrastructure of participation. Because that's not a right-left issue. That's not a conservative or liberal issue. The right to preserve the infrastructure of democracy, the First Amendment, and what it, as it applies to young people, as it applies to amateur media producers, is a fundamental right that we all need to protect if we're going to continue to fight all the other battles that we care about. And just as the conservatives and liberals work together on net neutrality, which is a kind of coalition politics, we got to work together on this one.
That's fantastic. So as you bring up online democracy, I mean, there's been a lot of conversation here at South by Southwest about the role that technology can and should play in a lot of civic engagement, everything from, you know, electoral politics, and then, of course, all the way down to what, you know, teenagers doing and their political participation. You know, where do you see online democracy and participatory democracy going? And, you know, what role should designers have in that as it, you know, moves forward?
Well, I think part of what we're seeing is the line between participatory culture and participatory democracy is really blurring. And I spoke at this is the Beyond Broadcasting Conference at MIT a week or so back, and I posted about it on the blog. So if people are interested, I develop at some length this idea. But essentially, the language of politics is not eternal. The language the language we use to talk about political issues shifts fundamentally over time. The bombast of 19th century stump speeches is very different from the intimacy of the fireside chats. Well, the fireside chats are rather different from the language of the Kennedy-Nixon debates, the language that Clinton used, on Arsenio Hall when he played the saxophone is different still. We're in a world where the participatory culture potentially gives young people a new language, that politics is going to become remixed. We're already seeing some powerful examples of that out there on the web. And I have tons of links in this blog post to various examples of people appropriating images, transforming them, using them as a language to talk to each other about politics. There's a number of effects. Right now, democracy is treated as a special event. If you vote once every 4 years, you pat yourself on the back, because most Americans don't even do that. Right? Well, we need democracy to be a lifestyle. We need it to be something we live with day in and day out, the way we live with popular culture. Right. So finding something we can integrate in. So finding something we can integrate into our everyday life means changing the language we use to talk about democracy through. We also feel more comfortable and confident in our role as fans and consumers than we feel in our role as citizens. That the policy wonk language of Washington disenfranchises large numbers of people. Whereas a playful engagement with these issues has the potential to turn that around and give us a sense that we know how to respond. Just as American Idol taught us a little bit about how to think about music, for better or for worse, maybe we need some forms of democratic entertainment that helps us to think about our role as citizens and think critically through that lens. And I think that's part of what we're seeing to emerge. So I've written a lot about what I call Photoshop for Democracy, which is, and it's odd, and I'm sort of being vaguely facetious in that term. But, you know, there are these amazing Photoshop collages people have created on right, left, center, responding to political issues almost in real time, that almost any day you could look online and find response to yesterday's headlines produced in that form. They are the people's editorial cartoon, right? That in the same way the editorial cartoon crystallizes an issue through comic imagery and helps people remember it, and those end up being in your history textbooks because they're so powerful at summing up the debates of a time, this Photoshop activity is, in fact, creating some very powerful images. Now, the challenge is that their images don't follow the norms of political speech as set down by newspapers. We're going to see some really vicious use of imagery. We already are seeing vicious use of imagery as we go to an election, where the front page of the paper today tells us what the first black potentially first black president, first Italian-American, first woman, all these candidates who represent minority groups in both parties. And what we're seeing already is incredibly racist images of Barack Obama, incredibly sexist images of Hillary Clinton. We're going to see, you know, anti-Mormon images. We're going to see anti-Italian-American images. We're going to see anti-aging images created by right, left, and center again. And that's democracy doesn't necessarily look pretty just because it's participatory. So we need, as we're moving toward a cutout culture, to also think about the ethics of our own uses of those images and educate people to think about the history of some of the images they're using and what their consequences are going to be. And that's why mediated literacy becomes an important part of ethics is evolving. We're in a period of enormous change. More power flows to us than ever before. But as one of my idols, Spider-Man, tells us, with great power comes great responsibility. Right? And we need to keep that in mind as a community as we think about how we use this power in the coming election. But I think the language of fan culture is going to be the language that a lot of the political activity of the next election gets fought with through. And we're already seeing candidates using YouTube, using MySpace, using Second Life, using all these platforms to get their messages across. as they try to figure out how to reach this younger generation for whom participation is something different and potentially something much more powerful than it's ever been before. But within it, we've got to figure out our ethics and norms as a community so we don't tear each other apart at the same time, so that we leave something left to govern. And we leave the capacity of whoever gets elected to be able to govern a country that will work together at least some of the time, on at least on issues other than regulating young people's speech, which, as I said, the one issue we all seem to, Washington seems to work together with pretty consistently.
Fantastic. So one of the other places that we've talked about with as common goods and civic engagement is around Wikipedia. And I know that you've been intrigued by the dynamics there for a long time. And what do you think is an important lesson that people can take away from what's happened with Wikipedia and apply it to the broader conversation around democracy?
Well, I think Wikipedia, I just was up in Middlebury College to explain to some of the students there why the history department, which has banned Wikipedia, is wrong, right? And it's in part because of this question of whether we're looking at knowledge as product or knowledge as process. And the most powerful thing about Wikipedia, other than the fact that people have done it, that this idea that you could create an encyclopedia as rich and as vast as Wikipedia is and do it with, you know, people bottom-up energy, it's the monument to the participatory culture in a lot of ways that Wikipedia is as good as it is. But that what's really valuable about it is understanding the process by how which knowledge is produced. That is, if in the history department, I'd be teaching them to go to the history pages of those entries and look at the struggles and debates that took place around them to decide what entered into that entry and what's disputed and what's not. All stuff that the Encyclopedia Britannica masked, right? And I had so much more respect for the Encyclopedia Britannica until I was recently asked to write an entry for it. And the idea that I should write an encyclopedia entry just boggles my mind, right? And I don't feel that I can possibly do justice to any topic that broad because I'm only one person. And the power of collective intelligence is lots of people pool what they know, create something. And the ethics, there is a case where the ethics of the community is so well articulated by the standards of what it is to be part of the way of Wikipedia and that people, yeah, there's disputes, there's disagreements, but there's a way of working through them and an understanding that you're trying to create a space where those different perspectives can be heard. So that I was talking to Jimmy Wales about this. Dana introduced us at a Newark hotel, and we talked a little bit. And one of the things we talked about was history globally, the degree to which in different national cultures there are different ideas about what happened, say, in wars. Different sides of the war have different perspectives, and their national history books reflect those different perspectives. Well, the English language Wikipedia, he said, is maybe one of the few places in human history where all those perspectives came together and had to coexist, had to negotiate what they agreed upon truth was, had to arrive at some shared perspective on what took place. And it means that a lot of things that have been swept aside that are, quote, inaccurate or biased in the national history books are treated in a very different way on Wikipedia. So you could argue for all the concern that historians at Middlebury have about some facts here and there being wrong, that there's more that's right in Wikipedia than in most traditional reference works, including revealing what goes on under the hood and allowing you to know that knowledge is disputed and information is there. But I think if we could figure out those ethics that enables Wikipedia to work despite all those disagreements, disagreements among American political parties, disagreements between countries that were once at war, how that works, we can begin to figure out how we could create a shared information space, which really does allow us to deliberate on national issues, rather than simply throw hand grenades at each other through our blogs and retreat to our own sort of partisan camps. We need to figure out how do we work together. And places like the Center for Deliberative Democracy has done some really interesting things, showing if you put citizens in a room together and you don't have political leaders there and you have them read some briefing stuff and get educated on the issues and talk through it together, they arrive at positions that no party would represent so far, but which probably are qualitatively of a higher order than the sort of simplified sloganeering versions that get thrown out by national political leaders. So we've got to figure out how to tap what Wikipedia does to create a culture where instead of, you know, name-calling, we engage in deliberation that allows us to get the compromises necessary to arrive at a coherent national policy that reflects the directions we all want to see our country going in.
So one of the critiques that I often hear of Wikipedia is the challenge to what is real and what is not, and, you know, all of these back and forths. And I keep hearing this more and more with a lot of user-generated content. I mean, we've all heard the stories of Lonely Girl 15. But how many of you are familiar with the UNC breakup video on Valentine's Day? I'm not going to show it because I don't have time, but I'm going to give the basic idea. A boy gathers around roughly 3,000 people to witness his breakup of his with him and his girlfriend because he's angry because she cheated. For anybody who's got a laptop, type in UNC breakup YouTube and you'll find it. And so about 3,000 people, they say, roughly gathered in a circle at UNC for a group of singers to sing the Dixie Chicks Not Ready to Make Nice song to her. About how inappropriate her cheating was, and she sort of, you know, responds back to him, and it goes back and forth, and it's a very uncomfortable video because you're not quite sure you should be witness to this. You know, you're kind of proud of her for standing up for herself, and it's just a very awkward moment. Of course, it flew across the web on Valentine's Day until 4 days later, the two people who happened to be friends announced that they were not really a couple. It was a complete hoax, and it was a test to see how far something could get out on the web, and they were actually kind of surprised at how far it did. And I found that a lot of people were really upset with it, just like they were upset with, you know, Lonely Girl 15, that they want things to be real. And I'm curious what you think of, you know, people's reaction to this, you know, age-old question about what is real and how we work through those issues with all of this new media.
Well, I'm reminded when I was trying to explain to my 25-year-old son who doesn't use YouTube for reasons beyond me, maybe the only kid in America who doesn't use YouTube. And I explained to him that Lonely Girl 15 would have proven to be fake, and he looked at me and said, "That's bad news for Lonely Boy 15. And it is bad news for Lonely Boy 15, and this is probably even worse news for Lonely Boy 15. But pulling all joking aside, you know, I think I'm often been understanding this through the lens of the 19th century, and there's some really amazing stuff about P.T. Barnum and showmanship in the 19th century, and this whole thing called humbug, which you've all heard the expression before. And humbug was stuff that was presented to the public with an uncertainty about its status. Indeed, P.T. Barnum would advertise and say, "The status of this exhibit is under dispute. Come decide for yourself if it's real or not." And this was a moment where P.T. Barnum was displaying the mermaid, right? That was one of his big exhibits, was this mermaid that turns out to, of course, not be true. It was a manufactured object. But people had to travel around and see the mermaid to decide for themselves whether it's true or not. And you put this in the context where at about that same time, naturalists in Australia discovered this thing that had a duck's bill, webbed feet, lay eggs, but actually was more of a beaver, and adding insult to injury, had a poisonous stinger in its tail. And they were trying to convince the world that that was real. And sort of, you can sort of understand why the public would be uncertain. Is the duckbill platypus real, or is the mermaid real? What's the status? And it led to some very early efforts at popular science education as people were trying to figure out how to use evidence to determine the reality of it. So it turned out to be a very productive moment. I think what we're seeing with YouTube is it's a mixed media economy of the sort that Yochai Binkler describes in The Wealth of Networks. That is, this is a space where amateur content, commercial content, legal and illegally comes together, but also educational content, nonprofit content, art projects. We're trying to sort out the status of what this is as we look at it, and it comes to us without context. It's very hard often to know what we're looking at when we look at stuff on YouTube, but it's producing a kind of grassroots media literacy effort as people are sorting through what's fake and what's real. Is this amateur content? Is it AstroTurf? And so forth. And I think that something really exciting may come of this, even as long as we can just stop being angry at being faked out. I mean, the interesting fake is itself shows a kind of literacy about how to create things. This is a story in particular that it's Valentine's Day, that it comes on the heel of coverage on Nightline and the Wall Street Journal and so forth on the use of the internet to harass people and to call people accountable publicly for their misbehavior, a politics of shame, people have been calling it. That it's a very well-timed and well-considered fake, if it's a fake, and that it sort of shows both sides trying to keep us at the peak of our game, sorting out the reality of what's going on and how we learn to contextualize what we see in a medium like YouTube. So how can we tell this is fake, but say the tasering of the UCLA student in the library by the campus police is real? When theoretically that could be fake too, right? So how do we decide, how do we put together that information, and how do we teach people to weigh representations, to think about evidence, to construct arguments, to interpret and discern reality through the mixed in media environment we live in today? And that's it brings us back to the media literacy stuff that I'm doing through MacArthur. What are the skills we need to teach young people today so that they can do that? individually and collectively process things like this to understand and know what's going on when they look at a particular piece of video. And I think that's a challenge the MacArthur efforts are trying to take on.
I think it's also a challenge I've seen you address in many ways with, first the rise of MMORPGs, and on into platforms like Second Life and all of these immersive systems. And I'm curious, what do you think are the important things to consider in all of this sort of rise of immersive systems like Second Life? Where is this going, and what are the sort of strengths and weaknesses of such systems?
Well, I'm fascinated with Second Life. I have my own avatar. I had it made for me by the Global Kids Group in New York. And what I love about it is it takes about 20 pounds off me. I've decided that television puts about 10 pounds on you and Second Life takes about 20 or 30 pounds off. And my avatar is now my ideal weight, and I'm working to slim down to get to the size of my avatar. But so it's great to have a Second Life that I can measure my body against and motivate me when I get on that exercise equipment at night. But, beyond that, I've been involved in this conversation with Clay Shirky and Beth Coleman debating the value of Second Life. And it's if people are interested in Second Life, trace back through it. It's been a pretty interesting exchange. And my argument is really that Second Life is a new center of that participatory culture we've been talking about. And some really exciting opportunities are there. I've compared it to medieval carnival, which is to say, and during the Middle Ages, there was a ritual time in which people stepped out of their everyday identities, took on new shapes and forms, women dressed as men dressed as women. Their kind of political transformations took place during that period of time, so that women in the community in carnival might beat men who were abusive to their wives. And this is the men knew there was a check on male abusiveness that grew out of knowing that at least one day a year, the guy would face punishment from the women of the village for what he'd done to his partner. That there were political upheavals in which peasants tried to overturn the masters, fueled by the energy of carnival. That the Boston Tea Party is, which we read about in our history books and seems like a weird episode, is an example of people adapting the images of Native Americans to break the rules for political gain. So if we think about carnival in that regard, or think about Second Life in that regard, as a carnival we step into all year round instead of a ritual occasion, what kinds of political transformations could take place, cultural transformations takes place as we do that, as we enter this environment which parallels our own, but which we can use to do all kinds of thought experiments? I think I wrote this morning in my blog, this is embodied theory. As we try out new ideas there about how economics might work, how identity might work, what social relations look like, what political culture looks like, what sexual identity is, we try them out there, we see what they feel like, who shares our views, who's willing to embrace our fantasy that we've built up, and then we carry that energy back into the real world with us. So I wrote this morning about autistic kids who were involved in this island called Brigadoon. And Brigadoon is a place where they learn how to socially interact with each other with enough mediation that there's distance between them that they can not be threatened, and enough simplicity of bodily signs they can begin to read social signs off each other's avatars and begin to see what matters, filter out some of the noise, and get a sense of what's going on. I also wrote today about a guy who's got a vision of creating a virtual Macedonia, and it's bringing together a new vision of a country already under transformation in the real world and create a sketch pad in the virtual space where people could create something different. What about a virtual Palestine where people could begin, who are part of a diasporic community, can begin to create a common space online? Or what about a new kind of configuration where people talk out across those national borders and try to find common interests? I think that those are things that a Second Life can give to us if we can think of it as a way of experimenting with social relations that we carry back into the real world. If we simply see it as escapism, we can go there and do whatever we want, it's rampant individualism, it's less interesting to me than if we can see it as a place for social experimentation that has an impact in the real world. And so one reason I really like working with Global Kids, it's an example of one of those organizations that does systematically use Second Life to get us to reflect on the First Life, and then brings young people together across the country as potential leaders that then go back to their communities and apply what they learn at the most local and physical level. So it's not about holding Second Life as a fantasy way of escaping the First Life, but it's about having another environment like carnival that we can experiment with things, learn things, and bring them back. And that's the sense in which Second Life is embodied theory to me.
Can you see why I think that he's God? I think that at this point I'm going to sort of cut my questions and ask the audience to, or invite the audience to ask questions, because I think many of you have questions. You're curious how Henry would respond. I need to ask everybody to line up at the mic, so if you have questions, please work your way to the center. Go ahead.
Okay. The politics of fear really, really bother me. And our political system seems to be driven by money. Is there anybody or any industry that has money that's going to be hurt by the politics of fear? And can we mobilize them to run counter to the folks who want to muzzle the kids and our culture?
Well, I think the people who are hurt, the problem is the people who are hurt are still making money. I mean, Hollywood is clearly hurt by it, but Hollywood is making money hand over fist. The new media industries are clearly hurt by it, but they're also making money. And, you know, I don't know that we can, you know, use the strength of the wealthy against it. I don't know who's going to invest in shutting down the politics of fear. On the other hand, the cost of, this morning's paper tells us that 300 made $65 million, almost twice what people had predicted it was going to do for a film that was made using low-budget special effects. How do we turn that into politics? How do we create low-budget politics, which has big blockbuster returns? That's, I think, what we've got to think about, and what we learned coming out of the last election, and we've got 2 years to get it right as we go into the next election cycle, is what we have is real media power that can be used low budget. But it can't be crunchy granola. It can't be bitch slapping. It can't be the sort of stuff we've seen before. It's got to be something that is playful, that is fanciful, that is witty, that people want to pass along. That what YouTube is teaching us is that some media is shareable. There's some media will spread rapidly, but there's motivations that encourage us to circulate it. And political media, civic media has to learn how to be something we want to pass along. You see it and say, wow, that's great. I got to share it with 20 friends. And it's got to go beyond the community of committed activists to average people who feel shut out of the political process, but who are engaged by popular culture. So I don't know. I don't know the answer about how to use money to shut it down, but I do know we can lower the cost of media right now, and we ought to figure out how to do it without while acknowledging that Hollywood and mass media does have a command on people's imagination. Stephen Duncan has a new book out called Dream that I really recommend to people, where he's arguing for a progressive politics. I would call it a democratic politics in the small d, that it's bigger than progressives and bigger than liberals, but a politics that is about participation and enfranchisement, engagement. And it really has some interesting things to say along the lines of the issues you're asking about.
Okay, thank you.
Hi there. When a lot of people talk about convergence culture, they talk about that this is all new territory, we're breaking new ground, we're going to have to change all of our assumptions. But we have historical examples where things like this have happened in the past. The ancient Egyptian culture, the ancient Roman culture, were basically mashup cultures where lots of different groups came together and they kind of adopted the same gods and everything. So I'm wondering if you think that, are there any examples, is there anything from these historical examples that we can maybe apply to the challenges we're facing right now?
I think there's plenty, and you're right. And there's nothing we're describing right now that doesn't have a history. The scale of what we're just going through right now and the degree of open-endedness is fairly unique. But if we take even the notion of you discussed mashups, and I've written at the Sistine Chapel's a mashup of the Bible that Homer, was doing a remix of Greek mythology, and that Shakespeare did fan fiction on characters from other people's plays. That's part of how culture has always grown. But participatory culture also has a history. We can go back to the pre-Civil War era. Young people in America were using toy printing presses to share their political views on the Civil War with each other across national borders. That's the beginning of the Amateur Press Association in the United States. That there was a moment in the early 20th century that there was thought to be as many transmitters as receivers in terms of radio, when almost every Boy Scout troop in America had a radio station and was using it in interesting ways, as were church groups and so forth. The podcast culture we see now has an antecedent in the teens and 20s in terms of radio culture. The biggest thing we learned from that is, guess what? Neither of those cultures survived. They lost. Right. And so we can learn not to be complacent and saying, wow, the technology will allow us to succeed no matter what happens. Well, history tells us otherwise. and that nothing is inevitably grows out of the technologies we produce, and there's no guarantees unless we collectively put our energies around ensuring the survival of participatory culture. These early waves came and went and lost. Now, there are traces of it. It's interesting. LOL, for example, was used by teenagers in the 1850s. Can you believe that? That some of the abbreviations we still use go all the way back to that print culture. So there were kinds of underground connections that could be drawn from the early toy printing press movement through ham radio, through early science fiction fandom, and into the early culture of the internet, that we can trace language that suggests that it flowed across all of those communities. So while it lost, it survived. And so the good news is that participatory culture is incredibly resistant. It's lost ground before and gained ground before, and we need to figure out a way to sustain it as well as to become part of, you know, as well as hopefully ensure its survival and success.
Hi. Your reference to Second Life as similar to medieval carnival reminded me of Barbara Ehrenreich's book about collective joy. And she basically posited that depression rose when culture became individualized and people stopped celebrating in the streets. Do you know of any studies linking or any planned studies linking Second Life usage or other collective environments and their impact on social disorders like depression?
It's an interesting question. I'm sure the research must be done, but I don't know a specific studies. But I think it's largely, you know, there's certainly that the collective nature of what we're talking about is an important message to carry away from this. That what irks me is people talking about personalized media as if that's the world we lived in today. The minute we entered a network culture, personalized media was no longer what it's about. There's customized and individual ways of participating where we live in socialized media, communalized media, media that connects us together. And what's powerful about network, the world of a network society is that social connection. And what, you know, so I get frustrated with the sort of critique of it as a narcissistic or as individualistic or consumerist, because it's just not the world we're living in right now, where it's about the connections we have to each other. And I do believe those connections can bring us joy, but they can also bring us pain. You know, that we've got to figure out how to live in those communities, because we're used to being these lone wolves living in suburbia, driving our big cars to work and back and living in a privatized space. And we're moving back into a communal space in an electronic world that doesn't mean we're all born knowing how to live there. And, you know, we still are part of that social experiment of figuring out how to create collective joy together.
I really appreciate all your comments, and I completely agree with you. Though, through all of them, there's one part that I'm not hearing, and that is, and this is a little bit about the politics of fear, maybe, and the environment. I mean, our second life existence is purely dependent upon our first life, and all of the energy that it takes to run all of these technologies is a complete drain on our first life existence, or at least the resources that are here, and it takes exponentially even more resources to produce a second life environment than it does to produce a first life environment. Could you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm very concerned about the environment, and I think there's so many factors affecting there that I'd like to see us learn to use the virtual world to increase our awareness of the natural world in the ways that, say, we've seen mobilization around an inconvenient truth as the use of media. And the Oscars going green this year was an interesting step forward of sort of acknowledging that media has consequences on that level, and we need to take account for them as we work with it. But the fact that young people today are aware of the environment as they are is in part because of the savvy use of these communication technologies, and not always in the expected ways. So my son, who's 25, we went to Australia about 6 years ago, and we went out in the outback and we hiked, and as a kid, I could never get to leave the city. And suddenly he wants to go to Australia and he wants to walk through the wilderness and wants to see things. Why did it happen? Because he saw Survivor, right? He was a Survivor fan, and this was teletourism. But what it did was give him some awareness of the natural world and what the potential threat to the natural world was. And so half the people there were eco-tourists, and we were tele-tourists. You know, and when I pushed them on it, the eco-tourists were there because they saw something on the Discovery Channel. Right? So we were all tele-tourists. We were just sort of, we value the environment on different levels for different reasons, but we all had different theme songs in their head as we were traveling through that, that environment. And if that works to get Americans and people around the world more concerned about preserving the planet, then I think it's a good thing. And there may be more gains than loss on that level. But again, we should be not wasteful, not spendthrift of energy. We should use it in a way that anchors our understanding of the real physical world around us.
Hey, I just want to bring it back to the stuff you started with, which is the fan culture, the science fiction fan culture, and so on. I agree completely. Like, I've seen some of the examples of it, and it's brilliant that some of these authors can take what might have been a genre fiction and take it to a completely different direction, maybe even more sophisticated than the original. On the other, it's very similar, like you said, to what was going on with, say, Greek literature, or taking the heroes that are in the common stories and the myths and making a literature out of it. But on the other hand, I'm not sure that there were line parties for Aristophanes' plays. So I guess my question is, there's a kind of dependence upon giant corporate special effects-driven high-budget culture that this fan culture seems to be highly reliant on, and I kind of find that disturbing. For instance, I read a story once, like, yes, I'm a Lord of the Rings fan, but I'm not a fan like the way they are. Is that, let me put it this way. I read a story about this line party that there's one of the actresses in this movie. She's not interested in the fan culture, but they felt like that they owned her somehow, that how dare you disrespect us? How dare you walk past our line party without saying hello to us at least? And I felt like that was a bit strange and a bit that they were trying to obtain a kind of significance for themselves that was perhaps inappropriate, that they were taking on someone else, that they felt like the rest of the culture owed them something for what they were doing.
Well, there's a lot embedded in that question, and I'll try to be brief because I see the other people in line. The first thing I'd say is yes, that one thing that happened in the 20th century was the folk culture that was participatory and grassroots got overridden by mass media culture. It went underground. It survived, it persists, and it's now resurfacing in the age of electronic media. We now have all kinds of participatory cultures emerging, but many of them are shaped by the residue and their relationship to mass media. Right now, as we move into an electronic age, it's predictable that that would be the case. Just in the same way, if you go to the early history of mass media, it was deeply shaped by the folk culture that preceded it. So I think we're in a period of transition. I'm reminded of what Mark Twain said about the telegraph. Someone said that the telegraph connected Boston to San Francisco, and his first response was, well, what do people in Boston have to say to people in San Francisco? Right? And I think as we think about the web, the mass media so drove out the common ground between people that it's inevitable that the global currency of the web is going to be mass media content for the foreseeable future, and that we're going to use mass media content to talk about stuff that matters to us. I talked to young fan fiction writers today, and they're writing fan fiction not because they're fans, but because it's the best way to get their stories read by a larger community. And it's about artists finding a platform to circulate their ideas from that people will engage with. That if I wrote a story about my high school, you're not going to read it. If I write about Hogwarts, potentially you read it. It might be carrying the same content, but it's through a language that's shared and is understood. So I think part of why this is going on is not just we love mass media, I frankly like a lot of mass media, but more deeply, it's the language we have to talk to each other across national borders. You don't know my uncle and aunt, we do know the contestants on Survivor and American Idol. We can talk to each other in that way. Now, as that happens, we feel a sense of ownership over those people. They are our symbols. And one of the problems actors often have is separating out the characters from the actors. That's their illusion, right? Sometimes fans have trouble too, but actors often mistake the appropriation of their characters for something that's happening to them and their bodies, and there's a kind of backlash in that direction. But if we go to the history of fandom, the 18th century, we already hear about matinee girls. who were there to see the actors and not the play. So celebrity fandom has a long history and a long controversy. And again, it's not a product of contemporary fan culture. Anyway, there's a lot more I could say in response to your question, but hopefully it addresses it on some levels.
I don't want to offend Buffy fans and the Macintosh fans here, but I guess I see it like I like to program in open source, and I see to some extent like the Macintosh people, they rebel against the system, but they're also highly dependent on this giant corporation to supply the new updates.
And I think I think we will be somewhat dependent on large scale corporations to create our collective fantasies for the foreseeable future. The good news is those companies are more reliant on us than ever before to generate those ideas in the first place. And so if we create a more porous system, we may still come out ahead on that.
Sadly, I'm going to be able to take one more question only.
It's really hard to weight or partition the fear motivation behind politicians' behaviors. But this question is for both of you. I'm going to ask both of you to try. I'm working on a tool that lets minors and job seekers hide content on MySpace and Facebook. And so I'm curious as to whether are the politicians concerned about who the kids are talking to? Are they concerned about what they might see? Are they concerned about what they might show? Like, what's driving this DOPA motivation?
I mean, I think partially it's fear of the unknown. I think it's what drives many adults, that adults are used, you know, when you're a parent, and I'm a parent, you know, you end up saying the exact same things to your kids you swore as a kid you'd never say to your kids, right? Because your instincts are shaped by the generation before you. And your security system, your norms, your default is, I'm going to keep doing the things that my parents did because that's what a parent is. And as we change the script of parenthood in America, there's enormous anxiety and disruption that's created. People don't know how to follow their sons and daughters in the second life. They don't know how to use and read a MySpace page. And that fear mounts. And all it takes is then some triggering event, a school shooting, a sexual seduction, that then creates national scandal. And then what you've got on top of that are political leaders who are saying, how do I appeal to those people out there, right? How do I target that mother who's worried about their daughter maybe being seduced by someone on MySpace? How do I get their vote? And they're not going to trust me on this an issue. But if I pull to the right on this one, you know, then I'm going to actually pull those security moms into my camp. And it's a total calculation. So we have this woman who would like to be president of the United States. He will remain nameless for the moment, right? And this particular woman sees a shooting in a Native American reservation. And a family, this history includes alcoholism, drug abuse, prison, insanity, gang membership, and a kid who reads zombie comics and plays video games. And what does our good liberal do? Does she talk about the plight of res kids in America today and all the social issues that led to that kid's life being totally shattered? No, she blames it on zombie comics and violent video games. Because you've heard the old joke about the blind man looking, or the drunk looking for his keys under the light post, and the guy helps him for 30 minutes, and then he finally says, "You're sure you lost them here?" He said, "No, I lost them in the dark alley, but the light's better here." We're going after this stuff. The political leaders in Washington are going after it because the light's better.
I just want to ask you to say thank you very loudly to Henry for coming to South by Southwest.